All right, we were on slide 13, and I've talked about this mostly. I was kind of cut off, though. Let me say a little bit about what's happening here that has to do with auto-regulation of glomerular filtration rate. Remember that the tubule, the ascending limb of the nephron loop, right before it becomes the distal convoluted tubule, comes into close proximity with the afferent and efferent arteriole at the vascular pole of the renal corpuscle. And this patch of cells, the purple ones, the macula densa cells, will be involved in part of this autoregulation. If blood pressure increases, that's going to cause more GFR, right? And therefore, there's going to be a higher sodium content in the tubule, in the tubular fluid, which is in this lumen, directly exposed to these cells that make up the macula densa. They respond, do you remember how? What do they respond to an increase in sodium? Right, they secrete ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And so that secretion means that ATP is now out here, outside of the tubule, where it is going to be converted by these mesangial cells that we talked about. And what is it that the mesangial cells do? I think that's where I finally ended. But does anyone know what they do? Did I mention what they did? Right, exactly. Yeah, I did say that. The ATP, which is adenosine and three phosphates hooked to it, gets converted into just adenosine by the mesangial cells. So the ATP is not there under normal circumstances. In response to the increased blood flow, the ATP gets secreted by the macula densa cells, which sense the high GFR because of the high concentration of sodium. And then that ATP gets cleaved of its phosphates, leaving just the adenosine. What is adenosine an example of? What is ATP an example of? It's an example of a nucleotide, right? ATP is a nucleotide. A nucleotide has three parts to it, one of which is phosphate, at least one phosphate. So ATP is a nucleotide. If you remove all the phosphates, though, you only have two parts left. A ribose, which is a pentose sugar, and a nitrogenous base. What do those two of those together make up? A nucleoside, right. So adenosine is a nucleoside. ATP, which is adenosine with phosphate on it, is a nucleotide. Therefore, the mesangial cells are converting the nucleotide into a nucleoside. And it's the nucleoside, in this case adenosine, that acts as a signal then for these granular cells that we see in cyan to cause vasoconstriction in the afferent arteriole. Notice that the granular cells surround the very last part of the afferent arteriole right before it enters the renal corpuscle. Right? Why does it make sense for those to vasoconstrict? They're modified muscle cells, these granular cells, so when they contract, that causes vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole. Why does that make sense? What's that gonna do? What's the afferent arteriole do under normal circumstances? Brings blood into the renal corpuscle. Therefore, if you close that vessel down, you're bringing less blood into the renal corpuscle. That's going to shut down, or it's going to decrease glomerular filtration rate. which is exactly the appropriate response when the error originally was too high a GFR, right? Remember I said the original problem was that blood pressure is elevated right now. That caused a too high of a GFR. The response after all these steps that I just described is that the blood entering the corpuscle is going to be reduced, and therefore GFR will be brought back down to a normal level. That's part of autoregulation. An even simpler part is that both the afferent and efferent arterioles, just like arterioles in general, are lined by smooth muscle. So all the red cells that you see, not the cyan granular cells, but the red cells that you see on both afferent and efferent, those are smooth muscle cells. And smooth muscle cells in general respond to being stretched by contracting. And so when blood pressure gets just a little bit higher than normal under just moment to moment, like when you start exercising, for instance, the higher blood pressure that you're going to have as a result of that, because your heart's going to be spurred into working harder, right, which is going to cause the higher blood pressure to begin with all over your body, that higher blood pressure in the afferent arterioles is going to it's going to bulge out the afferent arteriole, this higher blood pressure, which is going to stretch those smooth muscle cells that surround the afferent arteriole, and they're going to respond by tightening back. And so that keeps the blood pressure in the glomerulus from going up as much as it would in a normal capillary bed in response to the systemic increase in blood pressure. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's all autoregulation, because it's just the kidney structures, the nephron structures, that actually are doing all of that. But there's also, as you see, input by sympathetic nerve fibers. So the sympathetic nervous system has a say as well. Notice that they innervate these granular cells and can cause them to do the same thing that they would in autoregulation, but in that case it's not autoregulation because the nervous system is involved. All right, now let's go to 14. This is just a flow chart explaining what I just told you about. This is that ATP-involved part of autoregulation. So high GFR to begin with, and that's brought on by an increase in blood pressure, which would be a normal increase in blood pressure if you're exercising, for instance. That's going to cause increase in salt in the filtrate, in the tubular fluid, I should say. Macula densa hears about this, or experiences that sodium, which causes them to secrete ATP, which then gets metabolized or catabolized into adenosine by those mesangial cells. The mesangial cells, by converting that into adenosine, cause the granular cells to respond to the adenosine by contracting, since they're modified smooth muscles, and that reverses the error, because that's going to cause vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole, bringing GFR back down. So the rest of the body still has high blood pressure, but this nephron does not, because of this vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole. And therefore, moment to moment, so this is a very quick mechanism. And so this autoregulation is the chief means by which GFR is controlled moment to moment. And therefore, GFR stays about the same, and unless there's dehydration or something going on that's abnormal, GFR stays pretty constant, despite the pretty drastic changes in blood pressure that go on throughout the day, depending on what your activity is. If you didn't have that, the GFR would go way up when blood pressure goes up when you're exercising, and you would lose a lot more water through the kidneys as urine than you do otherwise. Okay, now to 15. This involves some information that we've learned before in a different chapter, in the endocrine system chapter, but it's pertinent here because it affects the kidney and because the kidney is involved as an endocrine organ. Remember that the kidney produces its own... strictly speaking, this isn't actually acting as an endocrine organ. The kidney is an endocrine organ because it produces a hormone, but what the chemical we're looking at here is not actually a hormone. Anyway, though, notice in the flowchart that the original stimulus, the event that's happening that's causing a homeostatic imbalance, is that there is a drop in blood pressure. Now, there's various ways for that to happen, right? For instance, you could have a gaping wound. If you're spilling out blood, that's definitely going to drop the blood pressure. Or you could just forget that you're thirsty, right? If you're dehydrated, that's also going to cause a drop in blood pressure because it's a drop in blood volume. And the less volume of blood you have in that closed system of tubes, the lower the pressure is going to be that's exerted on the walls, right? So for whatever mechanism, there's a drop in blood pressure. That's the stimulus for bringing in this mechanism. The kidneys respond to that by releasing renin. And I don't even know whether I mentioned renin before. Like I said, this is not actually a hormone. Renin is an enzyme. It's named, of course, for the fact that it's produced by the kidney. Renal means of the kidney. So renin is an enzyme. Now, what we did talk about, I'm pretty sure, is that the liver is able to produce what's called angiotensinogen. Do you remember that name? Angiotensinogen is not actually a hormone either, but it can be converted stepwise into a hormone. It's not a hormone because it doesn't have any effect in the form of angiotensinogen. Notice that it ends in gen, which means it can create something else. All right. Well, it's an example of what we call a pre-pro hormone. Two different prefaces that mean the same thing. Pre and pro both mean before, really. The reason it's called a pre-pro hormone is that the pre-pro hormone gets converted into a pro hormone, which is still not in its active form, and then that pro hormone finally gets converted into the full-blown hormone that actually has an effect. All right, so the liver releases angiotensinogen. In order for angiotensinogen to be converted into the prohormone, which is angiotensin 1, some of the amino acids that make up the polypeptide, which is what angiotensinogen is, need to be cleaved off. Well, naturally enough, cleaving off those amino acids requires an enzyme, right? That enzyme that does that job is renin. So the liver is responding to low blood pressure by releasing angiotensinogen. The kidney is responding by releasing renin. Renin, then exposed to angiotensinogen, converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. That's still not the active form of the hormone, though. That's angiotensin 1, like I said, is the prohormone. Angiotensin 1 then travels through the bloodstream and eventually reaches the lungs. The lungs secrete another enzyme, different from renin, called ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. So angiotensin converting enzyme does exactly what it says it does. It converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. It does that the same way by cleaving off amino acids, but it's additional amino acids. So instead of just cleaving off all the amino acids in one shot, it's stepwise. That's why we have to say it's the original thing is a pre-pro hormone. Assuming that the lungs are functioning normally and produce this angiotensin-converting enzyme, though, you make angiotensin 2. It's a very small note. It's only 8 amino acids long, but it's a peptide hormone because it's made of amino acids. And that has various effects on the body, as you see on the bottom part of the flow chart. For one thing, it affects the brain, namely the thirst center, and causes the sensation of thirstiness in you. That's an appropriate sensation to produce in response to low blood pressure, right? You have low blood pressure maybe because you have lost too much water. If you drink and put more water into your blood, that's going to increase your blood pressure back to normal. So it reminds you of the fact that you need to drink. Over most of the body, it causes vasoconstriction of blood vessels. Right? And vasoconstriction, clamping down of the diameter of those blood vessels, is going to bring the pressure back up. So that's also an appropriate response. It causes elevated blood pressure. This also feeds back to the kidney, though. Angiotensin II, which wouldn't exist without the kidney originally producing the renin, will affect the kidney indirectly because angiotensin II travels via the blood to the adrenal cortex. Now, the adrenal cortex is not part of the kidney. It's anatomically on top of it, right? But remember what's happening in the adrenal cortex. The adrenal medulla is really part of the nervous system. The adrenal cortex is the endocrine portion, right? And remember, you had the three zones we talked about? Well, one of those zones is responsible for mineralocorticoid secretion. And what did I say was the chief mineralocorticoid that you can cheat and look at the answer? Aldosterone, right. So aldosterone released by the adrenal cortex in response to angiotensin II affects the kidney. So it's the kidney kind of got things started, and then after several steps, the kidney is responding as well to the aldosterone. And that aldosterone causes sodium and indirectly chloride to be reclaimed, to be reabsorbed, rather than put into the urine. And water follows the solutes by osmosis. So not only are you saving the salt, but you're bringing the water back in from the tubular secretion, the tubular fluid, back into the blood. That's what reabsorption is, remember. Reabsorption means putting it back into the blood, taking it out of the tubular fluid before it becomes urine. And so, of course, when you reclaim that water, that's going to increase the blood volume, which increases the blood pressure. So this is the major way in which the kidneys are, one of their functions that we talked about as an organ system, is to help stabilize blood pressure. Yeah?
So angiotensin, is that between many angiotensin ones? Or is it just, is reading just like tearing it apart?
Just tearing off the unnecessary parts. So just one angiotensinogen becomes one angiotensin II eventually. So the kidney is making many, many angiotensinogens, each of which just becomes one signal molecule. Correct. That's right. Similar thing with, well, we won't get into it. Okay, slide 16. This is an extreme close-up, just a few cells big, of the epithelial cells that make up the wall of the proximal convoluted tubule. Now, we already talked about what the renal corpuscle is for, which is which part, which component of renal activity is the renal corpuscle responsible for. Remember I said there are three major things that have to happen for you to finally have urine. What are those mechanisms? Work with me here.
Is it filtration, reabsorption, and another secretion?
Yes. Filtration, reabsorption, and secretion are the three mechanisms that you have to have all happening in order for blood to be turned into urine. Now, which one of those is the renal corpuscle responsible for? Filtration, correct. So we've already filtered the blood at this point, and now we're not calling that urine yet because it's not fully adjusted, right? We call it tubular fluid at that point. But it's already been filtered. The glomerulus does the filtration. The rest of the nephron, which is collectively called the tubule, whether you're talking about proximal convoluted tubule, nephron loop, or distal convoluted tubule, that's all considered kidney tubule. All right? So the job of the kidney tubule is both of the other three, meaning reabsorption and secretion. Now, what's the difference between reabsorption and secretion? The direction is the difference. The direction in which things are moving. Filtration is moving things out of the blood, right? But only because they're being squeezed by hydrostatic pressure through the glomerular filter. Reabsorption is moving things back into the blood, taking it out of the tubular fluid. So those, reabsorption occurs for the things that you want to not get rid of. You want to have those still in the blood, but they've been temporarily been removed from the blood by filtration. And reabsorption can sometimes, at least for me when I was learning this, seem confusing when you're reading it. When it's talking about the tubular epithelium reabsorbing something, it makes it seem like it's bringing it into the tubule. Reabsorption, though, takes it out of the tubular lumen through the epithelium of that tubule and then immediately into the interstitium, but then it gets reclaimed by the blood, by the blood vessels. Okay, so reabsorption is always bringing it back into the body, into the blood. Secretion gets rid of things from the blood and puts them into the tubular fluid, but not by a filtration mechanism, instead by actually pumping things from the blood into the tubular fluid. So that's not only the opposite direction compared to reabsorption, but it's also different with respect to what you want in the blood and what you want in the urine, right? You reabsorb the things you want to have in the blood. You secrete the things that you want out of the blood and you want in the urine to get rid of them. All right? So both of those things, reabsorption and secretion, occur at various places along the kidney tubule. Proximal convoluted tubule, nephron loop, and distal convoluted tubule. But the majority happens at the proximal convoluted tubule. And that's what we're really looking at here in this cartoon. These large cells, one full cell and two partial cells in brown, are cells of the epithelium making up the wall of the proximal convoluted tubule. Of course, to the left you have blood in a capillary. Now specifically, that's the peritubular capillary, which hopefully makes sense to you anatomically. Remember that the peritubular capillary is one of two possibilities for the second capillary bed that makes this a what? Portal system, correct. So you have a similar thing in the vasa recta, but the vasa recta is the second capillary bed surrounding the nephron loop instead of surrounding the proximal convoluted tubule. So this, in other words, we're up in the cortex here, right? That's where the proximal convoluted tubule is, up in the cortex of the kidney. The loop goes down into the medulla. We're in the cortex. So anyway, the far right side of the figure with the kind of urine-colored background is the lumen of the proximal convoluted tubule. This is not urine yet, though, because we're not finished adjusting it, right? This is tubular fluid. So reabsorption would mean going from the right side here, taking things out of this tubular fluid, putting it back into the bloodstream. And like I said, most of that occurs at the proximal convoluted tubule. It reabsorbs about two-thirds of what gets filtered in terms of volume. So if you didn't have all this reabsorption occurring at the proximal convoluted tubule, you would immediately dehydrate yourself because you would be losing all that water that comes out as part of filtration. All right, now the important thing is what the mechanism is that drives the reabsorption of these various things. There's many different things that get reabsorbed, only some of which are shown here, but these are the major things that get reabsorbed. First of all, I should say that there are two ways in which things can get back into the bloodstream by reabsorption. There's two routes to take, as I've described in other courses dealing with epithelia. An epithelium is a boundary between two places. And there, if you're a particle trying to get through that epithelium, you can go either through the cell itself, in other words, by going through a plasma membrane, entering the cell, and then going through the other side of the plasma membrane. Or you can, if you're able to, squeeze into the space between cells. The difference there in these routes is that the space between the cells would be called the paracellular route, because it's next to cells, it's not in the cells. Whereas if a particle actually enters the cell on one side and then exits that cell at the other side, it's going through either the cellular route, or sometimes it's called the transcellular route. It means the same thing, really. Transcellular simply means across the cell. Well, both happen in the proximal convoluted tubule. The paracellular route is important because what would normally be very tight junctions between these epithelial cells, if it were in a different part of the body, and therefore would block most things from going through the paracellular route. Well, the junctions between the epithelial cells in the proximal convoluted tubule are not very tight. They allow a lot of different kinds of things through, including a lot of water. So, water moves by osmosis via the transcellular route, primarily, and solutes follow the water as it goes. This is what's called solvent drag. All right, notice that that's the paracellular route going through these so-called tight junctions, which aren't all that tight. Well, notice that things that are carried by solvent drag include urea, uric acid, sodium, potassium, chloride, magnesium, calcium, and phosphorus, among other things. So a lot of different things get reabsorbed simply because they're moving along with water as it's being osmosed back into the bloodstream. Or I should say at least through the epithelium. Of course, immediately on the other side of this epithelium is interstitium. This is interstitial fluid, right? This is outside of cells. So you're not into the bloodstream immediately. When you get to the other side of the epithelium, you're first in the interstitium, but then from the interstitium, things move into the bloodstream. By the way, an epithelium is polar, right? So there's an apical and a basal layer. Which is which? Which side is the basal layer here? Remember, the apical layer is also known as what? What layer? Well, lumen in this case, but that's not always, it's not lumen, for instance, for our epidermis. But the apical surface is always the unattached surface. It's the free surface. That's which side here? No, the right. The right is the apical surface. This is not connected to anything. This is just open to the lumen of the tubule. This is the inside surface of the tubule, right? But that is the apical surface. The basement membrane, the basal lamina, all these cells are connected to make it an epithelium, it's not shown here, but it's on the left side. It's on the outer surface of the tubule. All right, so this is the basal surface on the left. This is the apical surface on the right. So reabsorption means traveling from the apical surface to the basal surface to get into the interstitium and then eventually into the bloodstream. Everyone good on that? Okay, so just like in all your cells, living cells of your body, you have sodium-potassium exchange pumps working for various reasons throughout the body, right? But we've talked about sodium-potassium exchange pumps. They pump both things, sodium and potassium, right? In which direction, though? Opposite directions, correct? So it's sodium out of the cell, potassium into the cell, right? Now, there are all kinds of these sodium-potassium exchange pumps located on the basal surface of these epithelial cells of the proximal convoluted tubule wall. That's what this thing represents. Notice it's operating via ATP. You have to spend energy to pump things. But sodium is continuously being pumped out of the cell into the interstitium. In other words, to the left in this figure. That continuation of the pump working, always taking sodium out of the cell and putting it into the interstitium, means that there's going to be a low concentration of sodium inside the cell. It's being pumped out, right? Well, on the other side, the apical surface, there are various co-transporters. Remember, a co-transporter is a protein embedded in a membrane that moves two different particles at the same time through the membrane. And what are the two classes of co-transporters? Symports and antiports, correct. Well, you can see a few examples of symports, actually a couple examples of symports here at the top. One is a sodium glucose transporter, SGLT. That is operating as a symport. I guess it's the only symporter shown here. There's others as well. This is just showing you one example of a symporter. But these symports that are in the apical surface are all driven by sodium. So they're symports. There are different kinds of symports because they carry different things, but it's sodium something else symport. In this case, sodium glucose, but there's sodium other things as well. The reason it's sodium is the important thing to be one of those two is that sodium is always going to want to diffuse into the cell from the tubule because at the other side of the cell, sodium is being pumped out. So there's going to be more sodium in the tubular fluid than there is in the cell itself because of the pump working on the other side of the cell. And therefore, sodium will diffuse down its gradient if it's able to get into the cell. Well, the places where it's able to get into the cell are these co-transporters, including symports. That's why glucose gets reclaimed from the blood. Glucose is one of those things that gets filtered out because it's small enough, but it's valuable stuff, right? That's your fuel, your main fuel. So you don't want there to be any in the urine, and normally there isn't because all of it comes back in via co-transport with sodium. All right? If the pumps on the basal surface stopped working, that would shut down. Similarly for other things that are being symported. Notice that there's also a sodium proton antiport shown here, which means it's moving these two things in opposite directions. So the same pump that's operating on the other side, keeping the sodium concentration low inside the cell, is also responsible for getting rid of excess protons, which would acidify the urine, right? But keeping the cell and the blood from being acidified, getting rid of those protons. And there are also chloride symports, co-transporters. Chloride trades itself for other kinds of anions. What is an anion? A negatively charged ion, which is chloride is an example of. So these chloride antiports will just swap a negative in the form of a chloride for a negative in the form of another anion that you're trying to get rid of. The anions go into the tubular fluid. The chloride comes back in. What makes the chloride want to come back in? It follows the sodium. Sodium's moving in the leftward direction. And so chloride follows it electrostatically. Aquaporins are also important. Now, I said that a lot of water flows gets reabsorbed via the paracellular route, which is true. But there are also proteins called aquaporins. Not only in the kidney, there are other places as well. But aquaporins are water channels. Now, some water makes it through the plasma membrane of most cells anyway, even though it's not really supposed to, right? Because it's polar. It's a polar molecule. It should be blocked. And it is pretty much blocked, but some sneaks through. Well, in places where you want there to be a lot of water entering the cell or exiting the cell, depending on what the osmotic gradient is, the cell will feature aquaporins. That's another example of a membrane-bound protein operating as a transport protein. In this case, though, it's specific for water. So water travels paracellularly and transcellularly, as do these other things that are listed here. But that's the fundamental difference. Now, on the on the basal side, you have potassium chloride symports that basically reclaim potassium and chloride both for the blood, which are also driven, though, ultimately by the energy that's spent to operate these sodium-potassium exchange pumps. Okay, now to 17. So we don't see anatomical detail here. This is not really how it would look in a kidney, but this straight tube coming down from the corpuscle represents the beginning of the renal tubule or kidney tubule. So this is really the proximal convoluted tubule. It's just not shown as convoluted in this picture for simplicity. What we see here, though, is what helps water to be reabsorbed by the proximal convoluted tubule. Remember I was talking about angiotensin II, right? Angiotensin II will constrict both arterioles, but more so the efferent arteriole. Okay? When you constrict the efferent arteriole, that means you're blocking the outlet a little bit more than you're blocking the inlet. So you're letting more blood in, letting less blood out. That's going to do what? It's going to do what to blood pressure? Right. By partially blocking the outlet, that means you're going to pressurize the glomerulus itself, right? So that's really why you have a lot of water in this kidney tubule, because of filtration to begin with. Now, the decrease, though, in the vasoconstriction of the efferent arteriole means that there's going to be less flow of blood through that efferent arteriole, right? And there's also going to be less blood pressure in there. Well, blood hydrostatic pressure would oppose the uptake of water by that blood, right? It would tend to force water out of the bloodstream. So that vasoconstriction of the efferent arteriole makes it easier for water to come back in. Another thing is, though, that's what it means here at 5. By reducing the blood pressure in the paratubular capillary, it reduces resistance to tubular reabsorption. Makes water easier to come back in. It's also true, though, that the colloid osmotic pressure of the blood in the paratubular capillaries, because there are proteins in that blood, favor uptake of water. Water wants to osmose to where those colloids are, the plasma proteins that are in the blood. So all of these things are signified by these blue arrows representing water leaving the tubular fluid, going into the interstitium momentarily, and then making their way back into the paratubular capillary. Now they're back to being part of the bloodstream. That happens a lot in the proximal convoluted tubule in terms of a fraction of the volume reclaimed, but it happens pretty much the same all the time, regardless of whether you have plenty of water or not. So this is not really adjusted so much. The distal convoluted tubule, as we'll see, and the collecting duct do the final adjustment as to the wateriness of the urine. That's not happening at the proximal convoluted tubule. It brings it about the same amount all the time. But as a result of this, as we see in 7, that means the tubular fluid, there's less of it now because it's lost a lot of that water and brought it back into the blood. The concentration of it, though, is high because it still has those solutes that were put into it originally. At least the ones that haven't been taken back out and reabsorbed. Those solutes are still in the tubular contents. You reduce the amount of solvent, which is what the water is, that means the concentration of the solutes is higher. Now, it's not going to stay high, as we'll see. It can return to being high, but the tubular fluid actually is going to get more dilute before it gets more concentrated, if it gets more concentrated. We'll talk about that in other slides. But in 18, we're looking at the notion of a transport maximum simply refers to saturation. Transport proteins exhibit what's called saturation simply because there's a finite number of them, right? If something requires a transport protein to get it through the membrane, then as soon as all of the available transport proteins are busy, then that's as many of those types of particles that you can transport in that amount of time period, right? It becomes maximum. So that's what saturation refers to. Every one of the transport proteins being occupied at the moment. Well, there are glucose transporters, like we've talked about in the two slides ago, that are reabsorbing glucose from the tubular fluid, putting it back into the bloodstream because it's good stuff. And under normal circumstances, there's a high enough density of these glucose transporters that all of the glucose gets transported back into gets reabsorbed. So for glucose under normal circumstances, TM, or transport maximum, never actually gets reached. And that's why for a normal, healthy person, the urine shouldn't have glucose in it. What is the pathological exception to that? What's the condition that's an exception to that? When would you see glucose in the urine? Diabetes, right. Whose full name is diabetes mellitus, right? The mellitus part of that phrase refers to honey, sweetness. And that's because originally people recognized it by tasting the urine. It was sweet. It shouldn't be sweet because that glucose should be reabsorbed 100%. But if, for whatever reason, there's so much glucose that has been filtered at the glomerulus that there's too many glucose particles for the finite amount of glucose transporters to handle, then, yeah, a bunch of glucose is going to be reabsorbed. A maximal amount will be reabsorbed, but there's still going to be some left over that does not even get reabsorbed. And therefore, it stays in the tubular fluid, eventually becomes part of the urine, and that's why the urine would taste sweet in that situation. So that's a basic test. You just test the urine for the presence of glucose to see whether there's signs of diabetes. Now, speaking of this, why is it that a normal person would not have a high enough glucose concentration to overwhelm the transporters? The liver will take up excess, but so will the rest of the body, and so will the skeletal muscles, for instance, under normal circumstances. But when you say excess, you're referring to the fact that the glucose level sometimes does get really high, right? Or it could get high in the bloodstream. Under what conditions would it get really high or start to rise? After you have digested and absorbed a meal. Right, you're bringing those nutrients in, much of which is glucose, that's put into the bloodstream, so the glucose level rises after absorption of a meal. Now, if that were the only thing happening, then that would overwhelm the glucose transporters and you would start having that extra glucose in the urine. What is it that actually removes the glucose from the blood? Insulin helps, yes. Insulin is the hormone that's necessary for glucose transporters in, like, skeletal muscle cells to be able to transport that glucose into themselves. Now, the brain doesn't have such a thing, for good reason. The brain uses only glucose as its energy source, right? And you don't want the brain to die because then you definitely are dead. So The brain doesn't need any help to take any glucose from the blood into itself. It's always available to the brain. But it's not available to skeletal muscles, for instance, and other tissues, even if it's high concentration in the blood. That's because the body is saving it for the brain, unless it knows that there's even more than you need, even more, plenty for the brain plus some others. And that's what insulin is all about. Insulin is the signal that tells the body we have more glucose than even the brain needs. Let's open up these glucose transporters in the skeletal muscles, which is a lot of your body, so that they can use the glucose, that extra glucose. And by insulin working and opening up those glucose transporters, that's what drains the blood of that extra glucose and keeps it down at a level that's normal and that won't overwhelm the glucose transporters in the kidney. And therefore, 100% of it gets reabsorbed at the kidney under normal circumstances. But diabetes is an abnormality in which insulin either is not being secreted by the pancreas in sufficient amounts, you don't have enough insulin, or your body has started ignoring insulin, which is what type 2 diabetes is. You're making the insulin, your body just isn't responding to it as a signal. And therefore, it keeps that glucose in the blood, and then it does overwhelm the glucose transporters in the kidney and appears in the urine. That's called glycosuria, by the way. There's a lot of words that end in urea, meaning whatever the prefix is, there's that stuff in the urine. Normally, there's not supposed to be sugar in the urine, so glycosuria is an abnormal condition. Sugar in the urine. Okay, 19. What we're seeing in 19 is the final adjustment made to this fluid we've been talking about, and that has been changing its nature. It's been changing its composition along the way ever since it first got filtered at the glomerulus. Well, we've been calling it tubular fluid from the moment it leaves the glomerulus up to now. Here we have the tubular fluid emptying from the distal convoluted tubule into a collecting duct, and that's where we officially call it urine. And it's called urine at this point mainly because there's not going to be any substantial adjustment to the solutes that are in that urine. So what's been put in or taken out, secreted or reabsorbed, is now done in terms of solutes. The only thing that's going to be adjusted here is water, which is solvent, not solutes. So the distal convoluted tubule empties it along with other distal convoluted tubules from other nephrons into a collecting duct. And we have urine, but it's urine that's pretty dilute. At this point, it has an osmolarity of about 300. So it has a lot of water in it still, in other words. Sometimes that's appropriate because sometimes you're trying to get rid of extra water, in which case no adjustment would be made by the collecting duct. It would keep its aquaporins out of the membrane. This is the mechanism by which the collecting duct makes the final adjustment to the water content. Aquaporins are these water channels, like I said. Well, they only operate functionally if they are in the plasma membrane, right? They're proteins that you need to go through the steps of protein synthesis for, just like any other protein, in order to have to begin with, right? I'm talking about transcription first, going to the DNA library, transcribing the gene for aquaporin, making the messenger RNA, then going to a ribosome to translate that into the polypeptide that is aquaporin protein. Same thing for any other protein, right? That takes a little bit of time. So, too long for this to be a quick response. So the cells making up the collecting duct, the epithelial cells making up the walls of the collecting duct, have a bunch of aquaporin proteins already made, but they're not in their plasma membrane. So this would, if you consider this to be a cell of the collecting duct, it will have little vesicles, which are themselves made out of membrane, right, with aquaporins in their membrane. But those vesicles are fully inside the cell, so they're not useful for anything at the moment. No water is going through them. In response to the need to concentrate the urine, which would be what hormonally? What would signal? What would be the hormonal signal saying you need to conserve the water? ADH, antidiuretic hormone. When that reaches the collecting duct cells, the response is to take these vesicles that are already there, housing those aquaporins, and causing exocytosis. Now, not exocytosis to actually spill anything out of the cell, but just to make the membrane of the vesicle now part of the plasma membrane. And so now all those aquaporins are actually in the membrane itself. And now water can go through them. Does that make sense? So that's the adjustment that's made by the collecting duct, if it makes that adjustment. If you are overhydrated and you need to get rid of that extra water, then you don't secrete the ADH, and therefore those aquaporins remain in the vesicle and they don't work. So it's a quick way. You don't have to go back to the drawing board and create new proteins. Your body does do that, though, by the way, if you're severely dehydrated for a prolonged period. They not only embed them into the membrane, but they get working building brand new ones as well, so you have additional ones. All right, sorry I went over.